you're looking for. Cause I'm not good at making promises. But if you like causing trouble up in hotel rooms, if you like having secret little rendezvous, if you like to do the things you know that we shouldn't do, then baby I'm perfect. Baby I'm perfect for you. And if you like.
Not really sure whether causing trouble in hotel rooms is the best way forward, even though it is One Direction. Still, never mind. I suppose that's what Harry Styles started his career with. Anyway, life continues. Did One Direction actually cross the ocean to the joys of Gibraltar, Gabriella Peralta?
People do enjoy them here. They've never been.
Do they? Right. They enjoy One Direction in Gibraltar. I wonder, do they enjoy One Direction in Los Angeles, California, for Linus?
I believe so, because I've heard of them.
Right, fine. It's not quite in the same league as our discussion last night with Al Lyman and his meeting of Paul McCartney and the Beatles, perhaps. But anyway, that's another line for another day and another discourse at another time. This is the precursor to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. You've already heard two of our sensational co-hosts, Gabriella Peralta in Gibraltar and the amazing Phil Leonis, where it's just coming round to midnight in Los Angeles. We'll be featuring Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Dr. David Lewis Hodgson, who'll be talking about The Way It Was, a photographic journey through 1960s Britain. Corinne Sweet will be talking about the phenomenon of Evanescence and Christmas gifts. We forget what we've been given too soon. And Jasmine Birtles, ace financial journalist, will be discussing the whole notion of regretting what we might have purchased on Black Friday.
Siren Radio 107.3 FM. FM.
FM.
Online.
Online.
Mobile.
Mobile.
This is Siren Radio, Lincoln.
And as I thought might have actually been the case, the silence from the news thing. That doesn't mean there's no news. It simply means that our fine folk, in terms of the various technical side of things at the Sky News Centre, have clearly not been able to actually connect. We'll probably get that sorted through. We can guarantee that Siren News team will be with us just after 10 a.m. this morning. So it's all good news from that perspective. Let's say it is good news and happening news, shall we not, Phil Leonis?
Oh, of course. Let's say that the President of the United States apologized for his horrible retweets of certain videos that caused great consternation throughout Europe, throughout your fair United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. Let's say he apologized. Let's say he saw the error of his ways. Since we don't have access to the news desk, we can pretend that the news is whatever we want, can't we?
And isn't that the best way forward? I mean, as a qualified journalist, Gabriella, and graduate, and indeed ace practitioner of the art of journalism for the Gibraltar Chronicle, how often have you wished to go into a news meeting and the line has been said, let's just make up our positive news?
A lot. I think there's positive news.
Exactly.
I don't think everything I write is awful.
No, exactly. Exactly so. And that's why we do this.
Live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
Excellent. It's time for you, Gabriella, to take the lead before Phil takes the meteorological baton across the oceans and actually share with us the weather for the Lincoln region today.
So the weather is highs of 2 degrees centigrade, lows of 1 degree centigrade. After a frosty start, there will be sunny spells with wintry showers during the day.
Yeah. So, Phil, as you can tell, it's just like LA, really, in terms of that weather forecast, I would have thought. Or is it? What's your view and perspective?
Well, I can't tell you how excited I was. I know that this is awfully frosty, awfully cold, but I took great joy in being able to look up and see that it was presently 0 degrees Celsius mm-hmm. there in Lincoln, mm-hmm. and I could do the conversion to Fahrenheit without even doing any
Whoa.
Math. I automatically knew that that was 32 degrees, mm-hmm. and that's what we call freezing. So bundle up, everybody, because you are looking at some showers, I think, at various times throughout the day, and that could be really cold, that water. So bundle up. Stay warm.
Exactly. Tasty warm. That's the important thing. How is it sort of shaping up weather-wise for you in Gibraltar at present, Gabriella? Is it a case of you going to be getting out the old Mickey Mouse hats?
Well, yesterday was absolutely awful. We had thunder and lightning, but today it's sunny spells the whole day. Complete change.
And presumably it never rains in California, but boy, don't they warn you, it pours, man, it pours. Are you getting into the festive spirit where there's the whole essence of celebrating Christmas, just like Dean Hagland does down under?
I can't wait to talk to Dean about how I tried to embrace the start of the Christmas season by attending for the first time ever the Hollywood Christmas Parade, which has been going on many decades. And although, yes, there was a thrill in seeing Burt Ward, yes, the Burt Ward in the Batmobile.
Holy price, this collection of Etruscan snoods.
That was about it in terms of the thrill. It was the saddest, most depressing parade I've ever seen. And apparently it's much better than it used to be. So I can't wait to tell Dean about that. He's going to laugh at me nonstop on Chilpack Hollywood Hour. But I'm pleased to report that as opposed to last Wednesday, when it was in the 90s Fahrenheit here in Los Angeles, it is beautiful autumnal weather. We're looking at, in terms of Celsius, we're looking at maybe a high of 22 degrees today. So sweater weather, some clouds in the sky. What could be better?
Makes perfect sense. But as you know, Phil, there's one critical question we haven't put to Gabriella as yet, and it refers to her faithful friend and pug, not named after a character of Lord of the Rings, or maybe he was, the state of consciousness of Frodo. I know, people, citizens around the world, whatever the time zone happens to be, whether it's 5 minutes past midnight, or whether it's actually you've already had your Thursday, the 30th of November, and you're heading, thinking about, you know, the launch of December, if you're in the Dean Hagland time zones and so on. But you know, it's what we wait for, it's what this moment was made for. We can maybe do without the Sky News just the once or twice, but we cannot do without the information re-Frodo. Not that I want to build it up, Gabriella, but off you go.
He is very asleep and half snoring and hasn't had his breakfast because he's too tired.
There we have it, Phil.
That's delightful. That's... How old is Frodo?
He's only 3 years old.
Yeah.
But he's been like that since I got him. He's never the night walks, he doesn't want to do them. I remember the third day I got him, I had to drag him out for his night walk because he just was too tired or too lazy. And it's become a nightly pattern since then.
Gabriella,
there's a show that you're far too young to remember, but it was a classic show in the 1970s here in America and popular throughout the world, called Columbo. And the detective character, the lead character of Columbo, had a dog whose disposition was very similar to Frodo, it seems. He would bring him on cases sometimes, and he would literally have to drag him. He never went for a walk so much as he went for a carry. And that dog's name was Dog. So I think you did do much better in the naming department.
But as I pointed out, Gabriella, he may simply be astral traveling. He may be actually hyperactive in a dimension of which we know not. Just put that
maybe,
out there.
Maybe, or just really, really lazy, which is my...
You see, these are the discussions on which philosophers will put aside the notion of how many angels can actually fit on a pinhead and actually discuss what is Frodo really doing. That I think, is the message I'd like to roll out there.
Philosophers will lose a lot of sleep over that question, but Frodo, however, will not. Frodo will sleep soundly.
Shaylee's arrived, everybody, and she has brought coffee as well, which is why she's got two coffees. Is that one for each hand, Shaylee?
It's an apology for being late.
Oh, it's all temporal stuff from that sort of point of view. We knew that we'd work through a whole range of things. Gabriella, what does the rest of the day have in store for yourself?
Today I am going back to the office and writing up things that I need to catch up on because I am on leave next week. So I won't be able to talk, actually, next week.
Really?
Are you
not allowed to speak when you're actually on leave, then? Is this a new ruling into the three-mile
No,
ride?
But I'll be in Manchester next week for holidays. So Well, maybe I could.
No, well, I'm just saying, did you say...
Well, earlier, I've had to get up.
Did you say Manchester? Is that Manchester, England?
Yeah.
that's just up the M62. That's the place that they're already building special announcements for when Phil Leonis arrives in Manchester, England. I mean, this weekend, of course, they've got the For the Love of Sci-Fi event. And before you actually leave us, Gabriella, I have to point out that R.W. Sanders said he was listening to the programme last week. And I did point out that actually the bit that was featured one of his guests was actually the night before. He said, it's all right, I like listening to the programme. I like to hear Phil having a good time. And also, he likes the name 3 Miles of Rock as a rock band name. So that's for RW. Rolling that one out there.
I love that Gabriella can only be on this show when she has a job that it's taking her away from.
Yeah.
Well, I could do it next week. The thing is, I'm on holiday, so it just seems like...
This isn't work, Gabriella. This is just hopefully a way of engaging with the process of life. That's the whole essence there.
Gabriella,
it's a different time period as well. It's 8 a.m. Oh, on holiday, 8 a.m.
Right, but who do we contact to find out about the well-being of Frodo, if not you?
That is true, and I won't be with Frodo next week.
Oh, Lord.
He'll be staying in
Auckland. How's he going to live?
How will he live without her?
The charity of friends, the kindness.
Well, I tell you what, Gabrielle, what we might do, we might actually move your slot next week into the second hour, so it would actually be kind of same time in England as it would have been in Gibraltar. What about that as a negotiating point? She's thinking about it.
It's
a way forward. Phil, take those last two questions and bowl them across the oceans, around the globe, at least halfway around the globe, roughly, to our correspondent from Gibraltar.
I have so many questions I want to ask of Gabriella, but I guess time is running short, so I will simply ask...
We'll give you a special bonus one. After all, we're approaching the season of Advent. If you can't ask a question as we head into Advent, when can you? So off you go.
Well, I want to, as she's heading towards holiday, I want to know what is exciting her, though, at her job these days. What has her... most engaged in terms of the work she's been doing?
What has me most engaged of everything I do? I don't know. It's been the same as usual. I write features. I write court things. I write anything that comes through the door.
But there's been none that have really been interesting to you, particularly interesting? Well, good.
Exactly. Once again, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you know, back in the day, Edward R. Murrow would have been proud of, and indeed, let's not get started on the kind of incisive interviewing skills that so many, Jay Leno, just be there. Great. Let's go to the last two questions.
Well, I think clearly that she already, as the evidence, in the answer shows, she has the makings of a wonderful commencement address for new graduate students. Okay, so Gabriella, did you enjoy your telephonic link with us here today?
I did, thank you.
And can we look forward to talking to you, if not next week, then a fortnight from now?
Maybe next week.
Oh.
She's thinking about her. She needs her weekly dose.
Exactly. It's a great stuff. And Gabriella, this goes out to all the Californian folk who secretly wish that they were in Gibraltar.
Fire, 'cause I'm heading for the pride of the Inland Empire. My life's about to change. Oh my gosh. 'Cause I'm hopelessly, desperately in love with West Covina. The concrete ground. Hear the whoosh of the bustling town. What a feeling of love in my gut. I'm falling faster than the middle school's music program was cut. People dine at Shea Applebee's, and the sky seems to smile at me. It's all new, but I have no fear.
I see the fish.
And also by coincidence, Josh just happens to be here. What a cool-looking anime wig. And I've never seen a pretzel this big. It's my destiny, that much is clear. And also this guy, Josh, just happens to be here. Is he here? He's not here. To be clear, I didn't move here for Josh. I just needed a change, because to move here for Josh, now that'd be strange. But don't get me wrong, if he asked for a date, I would totally be like, that sounds great. Did it sound cool when I said that sounds great? Okay, how about now? That sounds great. Yes, I heard of West Covina from Josh, but I didn't move here because of Josh. Do you get those things are different?
Pablo Inglés.
Entiendes que son diferentes. Look, everyone, stop giving me the shakedown. I am not having a nervous... West Covina, California, West Covina, California. Hear the band playing in my heart, my whole life is about to start, true happiness is so good. Bye-bye.
Sorry, kids. Bunch of cuts.
Tuba anymore.
No, no more band.
Get that best dress.
And also by coincidence, so random, just by chance, would a pumpkin so remarkable and here right in so rare that this guy, Josh, just happens to be.
See, that is what you need as the time hits quarter past midnight in Los Angeles. Rachel Bloom doing the whole West Covina from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which I'm now working into my second season of. And as I just said, it's kind of like a contemporary Ally McBeal in many ways, but with perhaps more realistic figures.
Yeah.
And no dancing babies. Phil, if you haven't checked out Crazy Ex-Girlfriend as yet, I do so, seriously. It's a nice line, nice line.
And if not, a good place as well.
A very good place.
Yeah.
Hopefully he's still there. He hasn't been blown away by the.
Oh, direction. I am.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm still here. I just shifted out of researching about Gibraltar into looking up Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yeah, so there you are. There you are. So, CNN, Channel 7 Australia, Jeremy Vine, NTN TV, Ireland, Colombia, New Zealand, Spain, etc., etc. Lots of things to actually focus on our next co-presenter, who, curiously, with his royal credentials, was discussing something to do with an American young actress who's giving up acting and is marrying into, I believe, a former sort of German-based family that are actually occupying parts of London these days.
Alex, that description is brilliant. It does you credit.
Oh, I'm just building up for the full Phil Leonis introduction to yourself, Phil. Richard, Phil, Shady in the studio, Philip, well, Phil, let's get...
Transatlantic greetings.
I know.
Well, I mean, I feel like I want to congratulate you, Richard. I mean, it's not you have not become engaged, but it's so exciting, and it has to be... thrilling, is it not, to be the front row of history, and not only at the front row, but also given the opportunity to try to put in perspective for the rest of us?
Yes, I have to say it's been absolutely marvelous. I mean, this has been a thrilling week, and it's been historic, and there's no question about it, because 20 or 30 years ago, if one had been told that an American divorcee who was mixed race and an actress and an activist would be marrying one of the senior members of the royal family. This is the particularly important thing. Meghan will be, with Harry, I think, an absolutely dynamic duo for charitable work. I mean, I would certainly think that few would have believed it, and there's no question at all behind this. Firstly, two people have found themselves and fallen deeply in love. There's no question about that. That wedding interview was absolutely glorious, and I thought that it was really, the chemistry between them seemed remarkable. And also, these seemed like people, so as opposed to, pre-interview, our pre-marriage interviews have been, it has to be said, very, very stiff and starchy occasionally. But this was an absolute delight. William and Kate's was pretty good, but this was really, really important. And what we're seeing on Friday is that they're off to Nottingham and beginning charitable work. And also, there's no doubt behind all of this, so significant in that photo call, and that was, of course, they chose the sunken garden in Kensington Palace. And Harry was wearing black tie. Very significant, that fact, that seems to have escaped quite a lot of reporters. Facts are that Princess Diana is his inspiration, and unquestionably, I think he thinks Meghan is going to be able to carry her torch, because there's little doubt Harry's been in a tough place for a great many years, and with all our cheering, and there's no doubt at all that they've so much in common. They're both cerebral. She can cope with, or at least I trust she can, with the avalanche. His manner from heaven for the media to press attention that's going to, or has already, and will always continue to look at everything they do and examine it in its minutiae. But there's
Richard, if I could just interject one thing, what you just described made me realize that when Alex said that she's giving up acting, it seems to me that she may not ever be playing a fictional character ever again, but I think of acting as performing a role and doing so while embodying authentically the truth it is important to convey, and this continues to be in part her job. She has a very important role to play.
Yes, exactly. And also, monarchy is, I think, a piece of theatre. Now, there are those who say it's a soap opera, and there are those who, like me, believe that symbolic of national unity, it's got a great deal more that's important, as well as the flummery and the ceremonial. But there is, within it, is indeed the playing of roles. It is indeed the theatrical. And that links perfectly with not what Meghan's been doing, and, of course, her humanitarian activism in Rwanda, for example, for World Vision Canada, and I mean campaigning with the United Nations for gender equality. She's spoken out on diversity, and, of course, those are such pivotal issues for our societies at the moment. There's no doubt at all that this is perfection. An American princess, somebody who's mixed race, and therefore far more people, I think, who previously didn't identify with the monarchy, who regarded it as rather aloof and perhaps not for them. They might not prefer a republic, because republic statistics in polls, those who support it is tiny, but they will identify far more. And also, Meghan's style will be so different, and this will be something where there's so much talk, of course, of precedent when it comes to monarchy, because it has to rely on tradition and precedent. But here you have, and they know perfectly well they have, an absolutely extraordinary way of not only promoting soft power, not only reaching out to many people in a way Diana would have approved, but also the populist aspect of this. The fact Harry is tremendously popular, and, you know, Jamaica's going to declare a republic, and then Harry visits, and somehow it's forgotten. This type of charisma, you really have seen history. Absolutely, Phil, absolutely.
Well, it's thrilling, and I feel, very honored to get to speak to you about it, Richard, because it's always exciting to speak to you about any topic, but...
It's like receiving a knighthood, Phil. It's like receiving a virtual knighthood.
An honorary whatever. Exactly. I mean, I'm glad those do exist, you know, because it's one of the ways Britain spreads goodwill, and so many Americans have actually had them, but it's the buzz here, you know, it's almost tangible. The press has been totally favorable.
Personally, Richard, I'm thinking about Chelsea as possible crazy ex-girlfriend. That's all I'll say. You know, it's out there.
I'm excited. I'm excited about an American princess because I think it helps lead the way for you taking us back, quite honestly.
Well, this is a subtle plan that I wasn't going to mention because this was going to happen very gradually. There's a wonderful thing in the paper, but that if Meghan doesn't renounce her American citizenship, her children, one of them might one day become president. So there's always that as a possible. I mean, they're having a lot of fun with
it. Phil and Richard, you well know you're the vanguard in this campaign we've been having for, I'd say, a good 4.5 years to actually reclaim the colonies. You know,
well, you never know. I mean, this is one of the hilarious things.
We need to do something after Brexit. Why not actually sort of roll it back a wee bit further? You know, roll
when
back.
But antecedents, you know, it's a very interesting point. When William married Kate, there was a great to-do about finally catching up with the Scandinavians. And remember, we've only just in the 2013 Act caught up with the abolition of primogeniture and gender equality. Facts are that Kate's maternal ancestors were coal miners. And I noticed that Meghan's maternal ancestors, of course, her great-great-great-great-grandfather was a slave, emancipated in 1865, who called himself Wisdom. On her father's side, there were also a large number of coal miners. There's also a family called Howe, from whence she has some interesting descents, including one to Lord Hussey, who was executed during the Pilgrimage of Grace by Henry VIII. But it's absolutely fascinating.
Richard, I do wish you'd done some research in terms of this topic, because really, I mean, just coming out with these little things, it's amazing. Never mind.
Well, I've actually got one of the family trees in front of me, as it just so happened. I was looking through one of our papers. But what's interesting with the serious point is that the more diverse you are, the more can identify closely with you. And when Meghan and I saw her speech at the United Nations on gender equality, it was superb. I mean, you've got someone who's used to press attention, who's articulate, who is, as I mentioned, cerebral. And you've also had Harry, and this is a point that if you actually read some of the interviews Harry gave before the 20th anniversary of the death of Diana, you actually find that, whereas it's true the army made him, we called him the royal wild child, but there was an awful lot going on there and a lot that he was admitting. If you actually read some of the comments about trauma, about seeking counselling, he was indeed speaking out as his mother would have wished to help others. But there's absolutely no doubt at all that he was deeply unhappy. I mean, some of the quotes and also some of the views about the way the monarchy could, so to speak, crush you, who would want to be king, this sort of thing. I'm certain that
Richard, currently, Phil Leonis is actually king for the year, and it was made. We had the coronation yesterday, which I posted online earlier this morning, and you know, just bear that in mind, Phil, that you know, you've got that weight of the crown as well upon you.
Atlas, holding the world on your shoulders, is it?
More important.
Yeah, it weighs heavy. It weighs heavy, but this is why I take such an interest now in monarchy around the world, so I can take my cues and try to do so elegantly.
Well, may I make a suggestion? That is that you don't hire the equivalent of Lucian Freud to paint you, because his...
We know what you felt about Lucian Freud's portrait of the Queen. So
no, it was the fact that she did appear to be like Atlas, holding the world on her shoulders, when in fact the monarchy had moved on from the absolute catastrophes of the 1990s. I mean, at one stage, you could hardly count them. There were so many. And he was an autobiographical portrait. I believe, Phil, that you should do yourself justice, that he's excellent... posts that I read and the various Instagram posts that I enjoy so much, and I believe you should get a portraitist who captures this status of yours appropriately.
Splendid.
Well, a self-portrait it is then.
Yeah, in fact, you could ask Dean Haglund to do one for you. I just thought Dean could actually be asked to actually do a portrait of King Phil. Meanwhile, back in 1973, there was a tennis match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. It's 27 minutes past 8 a.m. in Lincoln, England, just past midnight in California. Battle of the Sexes, a comedy drama all about sport and directed by Jonathan Dayton. Would you like to take it further, please, Richard?
I most certainly would, because directed by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, I had been wondering how they'd handle this, because I do remember the offence. It's impossible, having been alive at the time, to have forgotten the razzmatazz, and that aspect of it comes across, of course. But what I loved about this film, it is about this notorious match, and what's such a joy is that the movie is so sensitive. It's so well scripted that its heart is Emma Stone's Billie Jean King. It's an absolutely wonderful performance, and it's so instructive to be reminded of a period. She was at that time married, and when she gets into a relationship with her hairdresser, played by Angela Riseborough, this has to be kept secret. She can't come out at that period, which is shown to be bigoted, both in the attitude towards women tennis players, something that Jack Cramer, rather well played by Bill Pullman, who is the Lawn Tennis Association promoter. Initially, he wants arranged matches with the women earning 1/8 of the men's prize money, despite equal ticket sales. So King and Gladys Heldman, played by Sarah Silverman, start their own tour. They get sponsorship, and you have the extraordinary figure of Bobby Riggs. I mean, Steve Carell is always absolutely marvelous. I remember Foxcatcher, everything he does. This is a film that depicts the sheer outrageousness of this character, a compulsive gambler, a disaster, who in fact was relying on his wife Priscilla Whelan, played by Elizabeth Shue, and pretty well, can't really cope with life, but relies on his family to keep him going when his wife throws him out. But nonetheless, he has ideas that will bring in money. And the idea is to play the number one women's player. They've started their own tournament, and their rivals, deciding to take on Margaret Court, he easily beats. I have to say, I had forgotten this first match, and it's extraordinary.
It was a long time ago, Richard. It was in the last century.
I remember because it was such a terrific spectacle. And the second match, where before the first, Riggs, who was himself a former Wimbledon champion and one of the world's top players, but he's 55, and what Carell gives is a certain pathos in it. He is such an utterly inadequate, pathetic human.
Are you saying that people in their 50s can't play competitive tennis?
I am saying that if you take on youthful Billie Jean King in your mid-50s, yes, you're taking on rather a lot. And the success with Court was partly because he practiced so hard. All he does is take junk vitamins.
And here was I, looking to put out a challenge to take on board Anna Kournikova, you know, as a kind of 21st century equivalent.
I have to say that the actual match, the build-up to it is marvellous, and you actually see how Riggs, so overconfident, he clowns almost unbelievably. This movie is marked by an excellent performance by Emma Stone. It's wonderful, she's sensitive, she's feisty, and also it's a reminder and the message as to how the LGBT bandwagon had not even got started at that period.
But on the plus side, there was a royal wedding between Princess Anne and Mark Phillips. How well did that finish? Let's move on. Shaley?
Moving on just for one second to praise the supporting cast, to praise the visuals. The tennis match is very well done, and a movie that's actually thought-provoking and has an obvious social message, as well as Emma Stone's, perhaps her best performance, and also one that's thoroughly enjoyable, and quite a few sporting...
I get the feeling you like it, Richard.
I did.
Shaley, would you be seeing it? Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it as of yet, but I definitely will. I really enjoy Emma Stone as an actress, and I like seeing her progress and evolve, which is really, really cool.
And Phil.
Oh, it's quite a nice movie. It came out here a couple of months ago, and I mentioned on the Midweek Drive this morning, or the evening edition last night for you, about Steven Spielberg's new film, The Post. Yes, I saw it earlier this week, and they're interesting companion pieces, because The Post goes back to 1971 when Katharine Graham makes the decision to publish the Pentagon Papers in The Washington Post. And Katharine Graham became the first CEO to be of a Fortune 500 company to be a woman. And I find it amazing that we live in a time where we must go back to the early 1970s to the Nixon era in order to find stories of hope. That really shows me what an odd time we live in now.
Not to mention the matter of Twitter, which I think we better stay off.
Please, don't go on to... We covered that in the early part of the program. You know, it's beyond Suburbicon.
Suburbicon, there was something I was looking forward to very much indeed. When a film has been directed by George Clooney and is scripted by the Coen brothers, we are expected to be entitled to expect, I think, something that is extraordinary. Well, I mean, to me this was, but it's all the wrong reasons that it's extraordinary. It's a supposedly ideal suburban enclave in the late 1950s. Its inhabitants launch a brutal campaign to keep their suburbs segregated, and there's some extraordinary scenes of visceral hate against a black family that has moved into the neighborhood. But I've seen the condemnation of bigotry far more forcibly in far better films, because I was rapidly, gradually, continued, and it got even stronger, and that is my impatience with this one. The story of the Lodge family, there's a horrific early scene, very effective, where a young boy, Nicky, played by Noah Jupe, along with his father, Gardner, Matt Damon, and his mother, Rose, Julianne Moore, who is confined to a wheelchair, and his aunt, Margaret, also Julianne Moore, they're chloroformed by men who, well, you assume they're robbers, and they murder Rose. But Nicky knows something is wrong, where he manages to see a police lineup where his father and aunt deliberately fail to identify the offenders. This is intriguing, and I enjoyed quite a lot of the first part of what becomes a black comedy, but the trouble with the macabre is that it can sometimes be ridiculous. And this was, for me, neither dramatic enough to be gripping or funny enough to be entertaining. What you have is an endless series of farcical scenes, and I couldn't help thinking back to Macbeth, the comment, "Nothing is but what is not." I mean, the problem with a movie that becomes meaningless is that you become very, very impatient with it. The bit I liked was when climactically we see an aerial view of Suburbicon, like the camera escaping from it, so to speak. I, too, felt I was escaping from watching it. It isn't that the performers aren't excellent. It's the fact that they can't do much with third-class material. When our Oscar Isaac turns up as an insurance claims investigator because there's obviously a good deal of subversive activity going on, the movie has its moments, and then even he, too, is put into a situation that becomes ludicrous. And the trouble with too much that's silly, if you're not amused or you don't find it succeeding, is that you can become completely alienated from it.
I'm sensing thumbs down here, as the New York Times critic Joe... Oh, right, no, it's not the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal critic Joe Morgenstern writes, "Suburbicon is not only unfunny, a bad sign for a black comedy, but deep-dyed dislikable." You can't say that about The Lady Killers, at least, which is good for suffering that
no.
way. Phil...
Yes, this expectation based on George Clooney directing and the Coen brothers writing it, I've realized over the last couple of years, this is, I think, the third A-list actor to direct a script by the Coen brothers, and I've suddenly realized that if the Coen brothers let someone else direct one of their scripts, it's because they know the script isn't up to par, and therefore they don't direct it. And Clooney himself, this is really the second stinker in a row that he has directed. Though Monuments Men was better, I found Monuments Men to be a wonderful story, lazily directed.
With a great accent from Cate Blanchett.
Well, and I think... But I think that since getting married... understandably, George Clooney does not put the same all-encompassing energy and focus into his work behind the camera that he did when he was making films like Good Night and Good Luck.
Yeah, I think it's a very disappointing and silly movie. I, quite frankly, a turkey for me.
Oh, no. No, surely a turkey for Christmas, post-Thanksgiving.
I'm afraid. Lord. That, regarding monuments, men, I must simply just follow one of Bill's comments, because for some reason I was asked to the press conference, and I had read in a tiny bit in some paper that Clooney had made a comment about the Elgin Marbles being returned, as I think they should be, to their homeland. So
that'd be Greece, in case you're wondering.
That is true, and I couldn't resist asking him. I knew what the answer was going to be, and it turned, as you know, into quite a storm here when he called in Britain for their repatriation.
You see, Richard, that's what you did. You set up that antagonism with George Clooney. He, you know, when he started his career in ER, he didn't expect to have that somewhere down the line over Monuments Man. Honestly, but still, appreciate where you're coming from. Never mind. Shaylee, will you be checking out Suburbicon?
Unfortunately not, no. It sounds like it's an awkwardly...
Got Julianne Moore in
there. ...jammed together plot. And I love Julianne Moore, but the plot does not sound great. I
love Julianne Moore too, but she's absolutely right. Okay. Third rate.
Third rate. Good Lord.
Wowzers.
Well, we've kind of covered the complete extremes, really, from the ecstasies of Harry and Meghan, two fine folk. Who knows where it'll end. Happily, I'm sure. Right the way through.
Alex?
Yes.
Alex, here's a little bit of trivia that might be delightful for you and the listeners. But you mentioned that when George Clooney got his start, it was on ER. But I don't think you're thinking of the right ER, because he actually got his start on a situation comedy called ER a decade before the drama called ER, and it was a situation comedy that starred Elliot Gould.
The untouchable Elliot Gould.
Nice.
Was he untouchable? No, that was Elliot Ness.
No.
Let me rephrase that.
No, that was Elliot Ness.
Exactly.
That was Elliot
Easy.
Ness.
How often Elliot Gould has kind of been mistaken for the head of the FBI squad, but it's just a lot. Okay, Richard had an epic sort of connection from that point of view, and I'm not sure whether Phil
is... an epic week, and I'm so thrilled that Phil's laid up for us, and, you know, I mean, it's wonderful chatting with you on a week which you're absolutely right. This is history in the making, and...
Look,
Richard, see the British royal family.
Richard, it was in the stars. Every time there's a royal wedding, Phil Leonis comes over to the British Isles. It's inevitable. Once Phil actually said, not necessarily for the wedding, but when Phil Leonis starts making plans to make it back to the United Kingdom, clearly the royals have to get married. It's a balance, you know.
Well, when will you be over?
I will be over in March, and certainly, I guess,
you, please.
When news...
Richard's like, you can stay at my house, Phil. I've got an open door policy.
It's nice that we're happy. Phil, are you able to stick around for Ian Lennox, or do you have to get some sleep?
I have to get some sleep, but I do need to talk to Ian Lennox briefly. I really do.
This is good stuff. So would you like to ask Richard then those last two questions, please?
Richard, did you enjoy your telephonic link with us here this morning?
I admit most particularly because your good self was included in the program and indeed has stayed up all this time to be chatting, and also looking forward to seeing you in March in London.
And can I look forward in the meantime, if I stay up again next week, to speaking to your good self 1 week from now?
Absolutely.
I remember... when I was a little girl, our house caught on fire. I'll never forget the look on my father's face as he gathered me up in his arms and raced to the burning building out on the pavement. And I stood there, shivering in my pajamas, and watched the whole world go up in flames. And when it was all over, I said to myself, "Is that all there is to a fire? Is that all there is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is." And when I was 12 years old, my daddy took me to the circus, the greatest show on earth. There were clowns and elephants and dancing bears, and a beautiful lady in pink tights flew high above our heads. watching. I had the feeling that something was missing. I don't know what, but when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to the circus? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is. And then I fell in love with the most wonderful boy in the world. We'd take long walks down by the river, or just sit for hours gazing into each other's eyes. We were so very much in love. And then one day, he went away, and I thought I'd die, but I didn't. And when I didn't, I said to myself, is that all there is to love? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep... I know what you must be saying to yourselves. If that's the way she feels about it, why doesn't she just end it all? Oh no, not me. I'm not ready for that final disappointment. 'Cause I know, just as well as I'm standing here talking to you, that when that final moment comes and I'm breathing my last breath, I'll be saying to myself, is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is.
So picture the scene. There's Abby, the girl in the life of Harry Bennett, and she's just in the cafe. And that's the Peggy Lee soundtrack that's coming through. Is that all there is? Is that what you had in mind, Ian Lennox, when that was actually there? That whole sort of essence of that. Because we're talking about Bare Knuckle, available on e-stores now and all manner of things. Shaley, did you manage to access Bare Knuckle?
Yes, I loved it.
Whoa, no. Let's dial back slightly, because it has been said, indeed by no surprises than folk who've been reading Ian Lennox's work, that Bare Knuckle is the equivalent of The Brothers. And who has positive things to say about The Brothers? We think it's Phil Dearness again. Yay, Phil! Now is your chance to share the things.
Ian, are you there?
I am. But my cat is probably here, I don't know.
We can always hear your cat. Is it Ollie or is it Oboe?
Oboe's meowing his head off.
Okay, Oboe is meowing his head off, obviously wanting to speak to Fuzz.
Just on the floor.
Oh, my word. Lords. So fellow feline owners as well.
Anyway, yes. Yeah.
Well, Ian, I love The Brothers so much, and I want to tell you just a quick story about how much it has captured my imagination. There was one particular day, it was fairly early on in the book, I think shortly after a very vivid passage about an arm wrestling match in the local pub.
Oh, yeah.
And
yes.
The aftermath of the gentleman going home to his wife, to Edith.
Yes.
And I just was, as I continued to become more and more, just immersed in the truth of the silences between these characters, how the characters express themselves through these kind of patterns of attitude and attack and retreat and parry, but not through actually talking to each other. And I was just finding myself so captivated by it that I needed to stop reading and just be with it for a while. And I went for a walk, and I found myself getting on a train and taking a train ride. And as I sat there looking out the window, a stranger said to me, "Is that a good book?" And I thought, well, that's crazy. I'm not reading anything. And only then did I realize that I was still clutching the book. I had spent all day walking around and on this train clutching this book. And it hasn't left my side since I've started reading this. So my question, good sir, is how does this come about where you write a story where these dynamics between these characters are so universal and so timeless, while at the same time you're giving me such a sense of the time and place, a time and place that I knew almost nothing of when I started reading the book, and yet I feel that I am in these rooms with these people?
Well, I think basically what happens when you write a book, sometimes you just fluke it. I remember an academic telling me that the guy who wrote Moby Dick probably didn't realize he was writing a great book at the time. I don't think the brother's a great book, but it's the best I've written, I think. And it's because I just felt the place and the person. I got the idea of writing it by when I read an autobiography of a vicar, a cleric in a small village in Northumberland in the late 19th century. And he seemed to do little else but shoot and fish, record the drownings of youths who swam in rivers, and talk in glowing terms about the local Dowager Duchess. And it just seemed such a strange society. I started to get more and more interested in the fact. What the thing that really attracted me to the brothers is the world in which they all lived, in which most of the characters never travelled more than 20 miles from their homes in the whole of their lives. And of course, what happens in a society like that is a very, very much a closeness which can lead to enmity, and which can lead to distance, ironically, between the different characters. And I don't know. It just happened, and I've been trying to write another literary novel for 10 years since then, and I failed. Eventually, started writing this, not things that were story led, but things that didn't lend themselves to really, really to a literary novel. And it's only ironic recently that I've got an idea to write a book that I will be able to do that, I hope. But strangely enough, I was talking to my friend Arthur McKenzie last night. Arthur's quite a well-known TV writer over here, and he's a very good film writer too, actually. He read the my latest novel, Bare Knuckle, and he said that he thought it was as good as the brothers. And I was startled when he said that, because you couldn't imagine two more different novels in many ways. One's about a man who lives a very violent life, and the other's about this sort of remote village that's invaded basically by great events about 100 years ago. So anyway, it's a rambling answer, but that's the best I can give you, I'm afraid. And thank you very much, Andy, for your comments. Alex very kindly sent me your radio piece on yesterday. I was appreciative.
Well, I love what you just said about how, you know, these people would spend their whole lives and never travel more than 20 miles. And yet...
When you start writing about the most important thing you've got to do is to understand the environment in which people lived, the times, the place, and restrictions. And the brothers, in that sense, it's quite a startling book because it's so extreme, really, to our way of thinking now. To most of you who would read the book, to think that.
What is amazing is within that 20 miles, they go to, for example, Harold's school when he starts school at the town school.
Yeah.
And it is as if they stepped into completely a different world.
Geographically,
yeah. It's no distance at all away from them. It's amazing.
And it goes further away into Newcastle, which is about 40 miles from this village. That's a big, you know, by their standards, a huge city. So it's like Rome. In fact, Newcastle is only a small provincial city, but it's got beautiful buildings and it's extraordinary for anybody to go there. Harold and his brother Daniel go. Well, Harold goes to work there, and Daniel goes to visit them. And they're just in awe of the place.
Clearly, what's going to have to happen, Ian, is that when Phil is officially contracted to actually make the movie version of this. Work. He'll need to have a location at Recce of Newcastle to act, and Northumbria to actually see this, which could be combined next year with his
he's most welcome. Yeah. Actually, Arthur was saying that he thought that the bare knuckle was made for a film, really.
I would agree. But Shaylee, you've been reading that this week?
Yeah, no, definitely.
Bare knuckle, the brothers, just gentlemen and players, the net, so many routines. Phil, we appreciate it's now coming up to 7 minutes to midnight. No, 7 minutes to 1 a.m.
Wow, Phil.
Exactly. This is it. I know, Ian, this is nearly 1 o'clock in the morning. He's waited to speak to you, to utter those words.
This is dedication, and I hope you're getting paid more than I am for this.
I'm not getting paid any less than you.
I think our tones reflect the love of the job.
Yeah, it's a favored nations contract we have.
it's a way forward, and we also have to congratulate your side, Ian, on finally stopping the rot. 4 straight defeats, but you managed to get a draw against West Bromwich Albion. Yeah. I'm quite pleased, obviously, that Man City have maintained their winning routine 6 minutes into injury time, and Raheem Sterling gets a winner yesterday. So good stuff.
Yes, I got it.
It's marvellous. Phil, would you like to put those last 2 questions to Ian Lennox, please, and then we'll reverse them to your good self?
Ian, did you enjoy the telephonic link with us here this morning?
I did indeed, and thank you so much, and happy birthday as well, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much, Ian, and can I look forward to hopefully speaking to your good self again in the near future?
I do hope so, yes.
There we are. Success and happiness. David Lewis Hodgson is coming up in a few moments. He's an ace psychologist who actually has produced a photographic journey through 60s Britain. It's called The Way It Was, and contains more than 200 of the photographs that David himself took during the 1960s and the 1970s whilst working as a photojournalist and covering stories throughout the United Kingdom, largely for European and American magazines. So it's worth from all sorts of things. We also find out where the highest rates of drink and drug affected driving takes place. No spoilers, but Ian, it's in the northeast somewhere.
I can name you 7 places at least.
It isn't Lincoln. I revealed that last night, but this is Kevin Pratt, consumer affairs expert for moneysupermarket.com. I'll be discussing the worst areas in the United Kingdom for drink and drug affected drivers. Much more to actually come as well. Phil Leonis, have you enjoyed your morning special here in Los Angeles for Lincoln? Has it been okay for you?
I really do enjoy the doing these late night link-ups via Skype for the morning edition. I really get a kick out of them.
Well, there we are. So I take it then you're okay for both slots again next week, all being well?
Sure. But you know what? I'm going to phone in, pretty much just be lazy with the evening edition, and I'll save it for the morning edition. Whoa. Like I did this time.
At least he's honest.
In no way, shape, or form does that actually mean that the midweek drive on the evening slot between 5 and 7 will be shortchanged. That's not going to happen. It just couldn't happen. It's just an inconceivable scenario. It's like the Coen brothers writing a dodgy screenplay. It's never going to take.
No, in fact, I now, having said that, I promise I will prepare something this week. I will prepare something special. All right.
So we are. It's Chilpack Hollywood. Of course, you can access all manner of delightful things with Ian. Not Ian. Unless, of course, Ian gets an invite to Chilpack Hollywood. Who knows what could happen these days? Sort of line from that. But Dean Hagland and Phil Leonis, that's it. We're out of here. Ian, we salute you. Have the cat settled down now?
Yes, he has.
Good. So yeah, obviously they've sort of recognised that.
He's wandered off somewhere, actually.
Yeah, obviously. But like Fuzz Aldrin, basically, who's there. How is Fuzz these days, by the way, Phil?
I'm surprised you have not heard Fuzz during this. Fuzz has been desperately trying to get your attention. So I'm glad that It did not interrupt the festivities in any way.
The name check is there, and that's the important thing. So to Ian Lennox and to Phil Leonis, we salute you both. Take care now. We've got a little smidgen of... No, actually, we'll talk up to elbow with Golden Slumbers, which should take us possibly to the news, although it may well be, because I haven't actually had confirmation that the Sky News link has actually been sorted, that much as we have construction workers still taking place in the backdrop, that we'll have to look at a couple of other sort of bits and bobs as well from that sort of perspective. So we'll just jump into that. David Lewis Hodgson should be with us. Fingers crossed. It's just coming around two and a half minutes to 9 a.m, which is an important time in anybody's calendar.
Once there was a way to get back homeward. Once there was a way to get back home. Sleep pretty darling, do not cry, and I will sing a lullaby. Golden slumbers fill your eyes, smiles awake you when you rise. Sleep pretty darling, do not cry, and I will sing a lullaby, and I will sing. Once there was a way to get back home. Once there was a way to get back home. Sleep pretty darling, do not cry, and I will sing.
Titled Brainwave there with Saturday Night Souvenir, taking us into the second hour of the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. And as promised, we're delighted to be able to connect once again with an extraordinarily talented premier psychologist, as we like to say, this time to talk about The Way It Was, a photographic journey through 60s Britain. It's the fabulous Dr. David Lewis. How are you, David?
Well, hello. How lovely. What a lovely lovely introduction. Thank you so very much. I'm flattered.
Well, I know that when we've done items with you in the past, we've been talking about the Mind Lab International National and a variety of other sort of key things there. But this little number was just an extraordinarily fantastic thing. I know Shaley McKenzie, who's in the studio with us, was quite fascinated by this journey through the 1960s, when, of course, you were into photojournalism in a major way.
Well, absolutely, yes. What happened was I was going to do medicine. I saw the kind of thing in those days, and we're going back far earlier than most of your listeners will probably remember. But at the end of the 50s and the 60s, you had about four jobs, I think. It was a bit like that in the Victorian times. You could go into the church, you could go into medicine, you could go into law. And these were kind of the options for a middle-class boy in those days, and not much else, I think. So I was going to go into medicine, really at my father's assistance, but... shortly after I started medical school, I went up to a second-hand bookshop in Charing Cross Road, if any of your listeners know it. It's a very famous second-hand bookshop road. And I found a book about press photography. The book was called People I Have Shot by an early sort of press photographer in Fleet Street called James Jarshi. And I read this overnight, and I thought, this is the life for me. Rather than studying medicine for the next 5 or 7 years, let me go out into the world. And so I that's what I did. I abandoned everything and I picked up a camera, and I was taught how to use photography at a school in London, what was called a Regent Street Polytechnic in those days. We didn't have so many universities, we had a lot of polytechnics, and I learned photography, and then I went into the world thinking that Fleet Street would snap me up, and far from it. And I think anybody going into any kind of media or artistic or broadcasting or journalism, it's very, very hard to get in, and I think most people will testify that. Once you're in, it's a lot easier to kind of move around. So essentially what I did was I set up as a freelancer, my home base, which is near Brighton. I worked for local newspapers, and I got some assignments for national newspapers, and that's it. I moved up to London. I moved into Paris because I was French-born, actually, and so I was able to work in France quite easily, even in those days before we entered the common market, as it used to be called. That's set up my career for the next 20 years or so.
David, this is a wonder. I mean, there's a movie just waiting to be made, and I'm going to get back in touch with our Los Angeles correspondent, Phil Lear. It's another one. It's fantastic. Last night, we were talking with an American reporter called Al Wyman, award-winning reporter, who actually
was
talking about his time meeting the Beatles in the 1960s, and obviously, from a slightly more sober point of view, the fact that he was the first reporter who actually covered the Charles Manson murders and so on. But looking at the 60s, and you mentioned you were in Paris. Now, 1968, for those folk who might sort of think, 1968, what was happening? I mean, there was a leap year, yes, the Paris riots. There were a whole change. I mean, we the year after the Summer of Love, of course, 50 years ago, 1967, the line from that perspective, it was very much a crucible of change, the whole decade in many ways, in which I don't think there's been a decade in living memory, arguably, which changed so much between 1960 and 1970 in terms of those 10 years. And arguably it kind of went, obviously, to the mid-70s and so on. But, David, as somebody who was around there, was that energising line, the fact that 20 years after the Second World War, Britain was finally getting its mojo back, we were developing to a whole range of things, we have the white heat of technology, as the then Prime Minister Harold Wilson was actually talking about.
Indeed, yes.
Did that all impact on your kind of time in terms of obviously developing the photographs that we're talking about today?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it was a very exceptional time. In 1960, February 1960, the Prime Minister was then Harold Macmillan.
You never had it so good,
yes. one kind of quote which haunts the man. But he went to South Africa and he said that the wind of change was blowing through the African continent. It might just as easily refer to the UK because so many things were changing. I mean, it's very hard to put yourself back. L.P. Hartley, the author, once said that the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. And certainly, in one way, it was a very exciting period to live through. So many things were changing. Music was changing, obviously, technology. We started to build Concorde. The QE2 was being built. So a lot of interesting things were going on in the medical, in the scientific and technological era. I mean, I covered a group of students who went out to Malta to build the world's first underwater low-cost house for doing underwater research. Yeah. And that was a very nice little gig because we spent 3 weeks or so in the Mediterranean. But so lots of things were changing. But at the same time, you know, I mean, in the book I say that really for children growing up in that period, it was the best of worlds and the worst of worlds. The best of worlds in the sense they had pretty much complete freedom. And their parents didn't worry if they, you know, they lived in the country, if their children wandered the sort of woods and byways, or if they lived in towns, they could go off and they could explore bomb sites or whatever without any kind of parental worries. And if a child fell over and, you know, bruise his knee or cut his knee. That was just part of growing up. These days, I think, with a health inspector and, you know, government inspectors coming around to see why you were abusing your child. And so, in one way, children were very free, but in other, they were hugely constrained. I mean, some of your listeners may be amazed to know, on Sunday, for example, all places of entertainment were closed. All shops were closed. The only shops allowed to open were newsagents, who had, I think, about 2 or 3 hours of opening where they could sell newspapers. And that was it. There was nothing else to do. So, you know, there were a lot of social constraints, and children were still being beaten in schools. You had to have your hair very short, often on the, you know, the penalty of punishment.
Well,
if you allowed
unless
to
you were a hippie, of course, in which case you could let it
grow
as long as you wished.
Yeah, that was the revolt. That was it. That was when young people started to say, hey, you know, we don't have to follow these laws of constraints. And flower power, of course, flower children were born, the hippie movement. Coming over from America, I think, from San Francisco. But it was quite a nice story. I covered the first flower child sort of Woburn Abbey experience, which was great. But apparently the Duchess was informed by her husband that flower children were arriving, and she thought it was going to be a flower show.
Yes, so, an easy mistake to make, I'm sure. I mean, oftentimes, when Shaley, when we did the first North of England Horticultural Society event and the Autumn and Spring Flower Show, you thought, oh, there's flowers, will there be flower children there? Shaley, somebody who's born in South Africa and has experienced this, and historically, obviously, has looked over this whole system. What are your questions for David, please, Shaley?
Just how did you go about getting into photojournalism? And because I've obviously just had a look at some of your photos, and they are exquisite, and they do take a chunk of society and just show it to the open world. Like, how do you go about getting into that?
Well, as I said, it's not easy, but I think what you do, you've got to have three things, I think, if you want to be successful. I think this applies across the whole range of kind of what we would call kind of artistic communications world, journalism, you know, theatre, film. You've just got to, first of all, be very persistent and never take no for an answer. See kind of no as a negotiating position. And the second thing, I think, is you've got to have a lot of kind of confidence in yourself. I know that's not easy, particularly when you're quite young, but, you know, you alone can do it. You can't do it alone, so you need to find people who can help you. Start a network. That's really what I did. I mean, I started off just with no contacts at all, and I went out to sort of cover events locally, which I thought would be interesting to the local paper, and they were interesting to the local paper, so they started to pay me for my photographs. They paid me a guinea, because that was a professional wage, you see, in those days. £1, one shilling in old money. It sounds very archaic now. And then they started to give me commission. So I think that's the second thing. So be confident in yourself. And thirdly, I think learn to be a good communicator of other people. I think I know a lot of young people who are immensely talented, who've got a huge lot to give to the world, but they're often quite inarticulate, and they can't really get their ideas across. So I think practicing your conversational skills. And I think one of the problems today is we spend so much time sort of texting and tweeting and stuff like that, we maybe lose the art of face-to-face conversation with other human beings. And that's something, you know, you need to acquire. You need to just do it by experience, really. Just like if you want to be a writer, just start and write. If you want to be a photographer, take photographs. That's the only really way up, I think. You can go to school, you can get degrees in media studies and things like that. But what really the newspapers and magazines these days, such as they are, want are people who with good ideas and good experience to do it. So the only way to acquire experience is to, well, basically acquire experience.
You see, we'd expected simply focusing very much on the way it was, but you get a masterclass in career postgraduate work as well.
I like you, yeah. The passion definitely comes through.
I think passion is very important. You've really got to, you know, want to do it. If you just go along and just do it, Henri Cartier-Bresson, the great French photojournalist, said that there was a moment of truth in any situation. And, you know, I think the good photographers, people like Don McCullen, for example, the war photographer, a whole host of other people who are really wonderful photographers, and Bresson, of course, himself, could just somehow press the shutter at exactly the moment, you know, hundreds of a second before, hundreds of a second afterwards. It might not have been a great picture, but because you can do it at that time. And I think one of the problems these days is people come along with, let's say, a mobile phone to take pictures, and they just spray everything. They're like, you know, using a machine gun almost to mow down their subjects. Mm-hmm. You want to look, see it with your eyes. Don't just see it through the camera lens.
Having said that, I wouldn't advocate a return to the magnesium flare.
effectively, no,
that's archaic.
Exactly. You know, but it's a balance. It's a balance thing. Anything else, Shirley?
Yes, I was just going to say, so having looked at some of your photographs, have you ever heard of a blog called Humans of New York?
No, that sounds interesting.
It is spectacular, and it's done by a guy called Brandon Stanton in 2010. And he basically, he just goes around New York and asks people about their life and if he can then take a photo of them. And some of the stories that you read on there are exquisite. And it sort of allows you a snapshot into somebody else's life, and you're like, wow, like, that's incredible, like, how they've lived and what their story is and stuff. I think you'd really enjoy it. It's sort of like a modern equivalent of yours.
And no pun intended when we talk about snapshots. Very
yeah.
good. The style
of. Oh, no, I mean, I agree. I was lucky enough because I never really did hard news. I wasn't particularly interested in the kind of... When I was working in Northern Ireland, for example, during what they euphemistically called the Troubles, I was never particularly interested in going out and sort of photographing people, you know, being blown up or whatever like that. What I was much more interested in, for example, the first story I did in Northern Ireland was in 1969, just after everything sort of started up. And I focused on the children of both the Falls Road, which was the Catholic area, and the Shankill, which was the Protestant area. And how were these kind of violence now coming into their country affecting their lives and their futures and their kind of hopes and things? And so I like to... You're absolutely right. I mean, there's an old journalistic adage you may well have heard of saying there's a story behind every front door. And there absolutely are. People have absolutely... They're fascinating lives. People you look at and think, well, they must have had quite an ordinary humdrum life. No. Very often they have absolutely amazing lives, which you know that blog seems to bring out, which I think is absolutely right. We need to try and find out about other people's lives because it enriches our own.
David, as ever, it's been a sheer delight, and I feel actually we need to start building a series around your good self in terms of audio connections and so on. A reminder, of course, that The Way It Was, A Photographic Journey Through 60s Britain, presumably available now online through all good bookstores and so on?
Well, no, because I've already printed a limited edition. I published this myself. I mean, in the past I've been published by sort of people like Random House. I wanted complete control over every picture which was used and the way it was all laid out. So you can certainly buy it through Amazon.
A collector's edition. That's the key thing. It's going to be wonderful. David, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us?
It's always a joy to speak to you. As you're very lovely and a highly intelligent audience, if I may say so.
Well, there we are. So, David, can we prevail upon your good self to join us once again in the very near future?
Anytime. You know where to pick up the phone.
Dr. David Lewis, a psychologist, photojournalist, general Renaissance man. We salute you. Take care now.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
I wish to stop it all.
wishful thinking, China crisis. It may well be wishful thinking to think that actually one day we will have zero tolerance when it comes to drink and drug drivers. Sadly, that doesn't seem to be the case, as a recent survey from MoneySupermarket.com has shown, with drink and drug driving offences actually up year on year across the UK. Now, to address this and to hopefully sort of point us into the right direction, who better than consumer affairs expert for MoneySupermarket.com, the awesome Kevin Pratt. How are you, Kevin? Good, but delighted to touch base with yourself. Although the topic of this one, I must admit, is somewhat sobering in every sense of the word. It's not good for that. We'll briefly rush through the highest amount of offences. In 10th position, Wolverhampton, then Reading, Wakefield, Wigan, Crewe, Cleveland, northeast up there. In 5th position, Blackburn, Coventry, Truro, and number one, very sadly, Sunderland. So, what, I mean, is it just a case of willful ignoring of the rules? What's the sort of situation behind this survey in terms of the findings, Kevin?
Yeah, I think there are some people who are immune to the message that drink driving is one of the most selfish things that you can do, and they will consider themselves fit to drive no matter what state they're in. And how you reach those people, I really don't know. But there are also a lot of people who are caught unwittingly, especially the morning after the night before, because they perhaps think that they're fit to drive, but they're not aware that the alcohol actually lingers in their system for a long, long time. So you could be setting off for work, or you could be going to do the school run, maybe, having had a few drinks the night before, and you could still be over the limit, and you could still be unfit to drive. And what we need to remember is that the police make no distinction whatsoever whether it's 8 o'clock in the morning or midnight. It's the same offence. You pose the same threat on the road, and you'll be punished in exactly the same way. So there are people who unwittingly break the law, and they get punished accordingly.
Were you surprised by the research in terms of the geographical notion? I mean, in a sense, it's good to see that London, in this particular instance, actually has the lowest rates.
Yes, and that probably comes down to the availability and the reliability of public transport, because in places that are served by, in London now, they have a tube that runs through the night, so it's easy to get home. Or it's a lot easier than it is in rural areas or in towns that aren't as well served by public transport, and where the cost of getting a cab is prohibitive, and it sometimes tempts people into jumping behind the wheel, and that's when the problems start.
Shirley.
No, it is very sobering indeed, and I do feel like, especially for my generation, we are more aware of it than perhaps the older generations. So, for instance, if we would go out and have a few in the pub, I would never, ever, ever in a million years let one of my friends get behind a wheel, ever.
And yet, Shaylee, looking at this particular aspect, the over 65s are actually leading the way when it comes to staying safe behind the wheel. Conviction rate for drink or drug driving was the second lowest amongst 17 to 19-year-olds, so right from that perspective. And then apparently drivers between 25 and 29, much higher rate.
I take that back then. Maybe it's just me and my friends.
Is it just a case, Kevin, of actually, again, getting the message out that, look, it is just not acceptable. Do not do it. No, you can't use the excuse of, oh, there's no transport along.
And the morning after thing is really interesting, because you do have to be really careful.
Oh. Indeed. And especially at this time of year, when you think about people going out for Christmas lunches, maybe, or a few drinks at lunch, that alcohol might still be in your system when you drive home after work. And again, people think they've sobered up, but they haven't. The golden rule is, if you feel in any way affected by alcohol,
don't risk it. So,
don't risk it. If you've got a headache when you wake up in the morning, it's no good having a shower, brushing your teeth, and having a fried breakfast. That won't cure it. That won't get rid of the alcohol. It'll still be there. And same thing with the evening commute home. Just because it's a couple of hours have elapsed since you came home, came back to the office from the pub, you might still be drunk, and that's when you're going to cause problems.
And equally, we'd obviously say in terms of actual, it's not just causing problems for other people, you're causing problems for yourself. It's a vicious cycle. It just goes down. Hence the reason we just say just now. We're talking, obviously, drink and drug, and clearly alcohol is a drug from that point of view. Are we finding that you're getting other recreational usages of drug? Because there is that line about changing the breathalyzer test, actually ensuring that you have tests for people who might have actually been taking illicit substances as well.
Yeah, the rules changed in 2015, and strict limits were brought in, and not just for illegal drugs. It's important that people remember that they can be convicted for a drug driving offence if they're taking prescription medicine. So you really need to talk to your doctor about the effect that any prescription drugs you have will have on your driving. Because again, if you're impaired through any kinds of narcotic or drug or alcohol, then you'll be convicted of an offence and you'll be banned for a year. That's going to happen regardless. You'll be banned for a year. You face an unlimited fine. You could be sent to jail for 6 months, and you'll probably see your insurance premiums double. So think of that as a package of measures that will really be a life-changing set of circumstances for you. And that's regardless of whether you're involved in an accident and cause injury or even death to somebody else.
So ignorance is no excuse at all, no.
Ignorance is no excuse whatsoever, I'm afraid.
Kevin, where can people go to find out more details about this particular survey and actually drill down it? Say it's rather sad news to see the number of northeastern bases or towns in the north that are actually there. I think it's only Truro that effectively sort of bucks the trend,
yeah,
as we mentioned.
It fluctuates from year to year, but if you want to find out what your particular postcode, what the rate of convictions is there in your local area, if you look for Money Supermarket on social media, so Twitter or Facebook, we'll link you through to an interactive map that you can explore and find out the details for every postcode in the UK.
Kevin, as we knew it would be, an informative and, as we said, no cliche intended, a sobering line of approach there, certainly as we head into the festive season, the party season, etc. End of the day, designated drivers, public transport, these are the things you need to write in, as much as probably actually wearing clothes, it has to be said. You know, wearing the right outfit, etc. If you plan that thing, you need to plan your transport and all the other bits and pieces as we head through the area, because, as we said, the ramifications are immense, and the incentives of actually maintaining your sort of standard things, par for the course. Will you be kind enough to return in 2018, Kevin, to keep us updated in terms of how things are going, possibly with other MoneySupermarket.com scenarios?
Of course I will. Happy to.
Hey. Now just get in and close the door and put your foot down. You know, I like this suburb we're going through. I've been around here many times before. When I was young, we were going to move out this way for the clean air. Healthy, you know, away from the factories and the smog. I like that shop too. You can get anything there. So just get in and we'll go for a ride. Let's still go driving away from home, 30 miles or more. Cross the city limit and head on down the M62. It's only 39 miles and 45 minutes to Manchester, and that's my birthplace. Driving away from home, 30 miles or more, and we'll go moving away from home without a care in the world.
Evanescence. It's a wonderful word, it's a wonderful band. It's that term which is used to apply to the slow fading of memory as things begin to pass us by. And it seems that the same thing occurs when it comes to remembering what gifts we received at Christmas. 56% of British folk can't actually recall what Christmas gifts they received last year, and that number gets higher with the passing of time. 82% can't actually remember what they received 3 years ago. Now, research published from Butlins has, again, come up with these figures. So, allowing for the whole notion of, as we said, evanescence, we're delighted to talk about this research with ace psychologist, the truly wonderful, amazingly talented, amazing Corinne Sweet. How are you, Corinne?
I'm fine. After that introduction, who would not be fine? Fantastic.
It's always good to connect with your good self. Now, as we said, this whole notion of presents aren't what they used to be. Christmases back in the day, in the 20th century, they were all snowy white Christmases and so on. Do we romanticise? Is that the whole thing? And in case we remember the best bits, we don't remember that pair of socks, which we really didn't want after all, because we don't follow that particular band or artist or indeed child's toy character.
Well, indeed, I think often we do remember that pair of socks because we don't want them again. But I think it's interesting, the survey that's been done by Butlins has found out that 56% of us actually don't remember what we got last year. And where you are, actually, you're a little bit more good at remembering what you got. But one of the most interesting things is that 61% of you do remember what you got 10 years ago. And I think it's above the national average. So I don't know if that means you're particularly sentimental or you're good at counting what you got for Christmas in your stocking. But you're way above the national average. And actually, if you were in London, you wouldn't remember anything. Maybe it's because of the way London lives its life. Who knows?
So much pace. Of course, back in the days of the ancient Greek times, we had Socrates and Plato. I believe Socrates was actually saying he never wanted people to write down things because he wanted the oral tradition to be there, because without an oral tradition, we wouldn't remember things. So is one of the reasons we're seeing this maybe due to the fact that actually, you know, if we're not writing, if we don't have the Facebook update, if we don't have the sort of validation for the whole thing, and we just rely on memory, our memories are beginning to fade?
Well, I think it's to do, in a way, this survey has looked at what we remember and what we don't remember. And it's one of the interesting things from a psychological viewpoint, as well as a Socratic dialogue that you might enter into, is that we tend to remember experiences and things that, say, involve our autonomous nervous system. So, for instance, if you go and climb a mountain, or you go on a chairlift, or you do something exciting, or you have fun where you're laughing and you have an emotional connection with people, you tend to remember that more in your memory, in your sort of long-term memory store. You tend to remember that more than stuff, because stuff is an external thing, you know, the gadgets that gather dust beautifully in the cupboard, although they were the thing that you really did want. Those things kind of, they have a moment and then they're gone. But the things that we tend to remember, the things that link to our emotions, the things that link to meaning or to memory or to connection with sort of culture or family or friends.
That classic holiday at Butlins when a whole new world was opening up for a whole variety of things, which clearly ties in with that notion of vivid memories, the ways in which those memory engrams are kind of laid down and so on. I mean, it sounds very kind of clinical on one level, but from this perspective, is one way of actually remembering your Christmas gift looking to associate it with good possible good times and getting that whole notion of smells, flavours and so on and so forth?
Yes, I mean, it was very interesting. The survey found that people remember in a sort of hierarchy of memory, if you like. They remember sights more than flavours, or they remember family and friends more than smells, although they may be associated sometimes, especially with younger members. But, you know, things like food, 48% of people remember the food they ate somewhere, or the experience that they had. I mean, I've had some great holidays, family holidays, with my daughter when she's growing up. You know, we did those sort of tree climbing things, and we did zip wires, and we'll always remember those things because they were things where we laughed and we screamed, or we just had fun. And I think that's what you remember more than that wonderful pair of socks, as you said, or the best pair of knickers you've ever had.
Actually, that's an interesting one, Corinne. I must admit, that's one I hadn't thought about in terms of undergarments, but I suppose there is that message that could be coming across from that line. Maybe it's paraphrasing the old September song, "Try to Remember the Kind of December When Life Was Exciting and Dynamic," and so on. On another slightly serious note, given that clearly people do get worried when they start forgetting things, it's important that we actually say, look, it's natural. You do actually fade. The memories fade. It's a natural process, and there are ways you actually around it. It's not a case that you're suddenly going to be afflicted by Alzheimer's or other debilitating diseases.
But there's lots of things that interfere with memory. And I was interested, the statistics and survey showed that London, as I said earlier, is a place where we don't really remember anything. And I think it's to do with the speed of life. And we're all living at great, great pace at the moment. In the run-up to things like Christmas, we're all very busy. We're all very stressed. The pace of life is increasing. And, you know, we're all worrying about buying our Christmas shopping and the sales, and all sorts of stuff gets in the way. And when you have pressure and stress, that interferes with memory. Trauma interferes with memory. And in a way, if we can slow down and even take a moment every day just to take that 5 minutes, just to chill, then we can probably remember more, or at least recover memory. And I think a lot of us are frightened now. I wrote a book last year on anxiety, and a lot of us are very anxious at this time of year because there's so much to do, and, you know, it's dark and it's cold and it's uncomfortable. So I think if you can actually build into your life some good experiences, you can have some times where you chill out and slow down. You'll probably get more out of that long term than queuing up for hours trying to buy something.
I have this vision of greater London region being filled with people who basically have the attention span of Finding Dory, which I suppose could be good on one hand, but on the other hand, at least, you know, it's a way forward. And I think you've raised some really key points there in terms of ways forward. I always like to say that the human life form, we actually need to reboot just like computers. So sometimes you need to actually switch off, quite literally, to kind of bring back the best of times and maybe even the worst of times.
Indeed. I think there's a sort of counterintuitive thing that if you slow down a bit, you speed up. And if you overspeed, you slow down. Mm. You know, and I think that's one of the things that all of us have to think about at this time of year.
A very key life skill on which to conclude this particular item, Corinne. I'd clearly recommend corinnesweet.com as a go-to website for finding out more information about your good self. Is there another line where you say we should contact Butlins as well, or find out more about this particular survey vis-a-vis ways in which people can dig a little bit deeper into what the findings have revealed?
Well, I would say if you want to find out more about the survey and also just about how to chill out, go to allthews.butlins.com.
There we are, chill out at Butlins. What a wonderful way to actually sort of open up a whole new season side of things. Two final questions, Corinne. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic and hopefully maybe even memorable link with us today, as I'd like to feel we've moved from evanescence through Socratic questioning through various other things, which I hope you won't be sort of repeating on too many other radio stations later on today?
I think it'll be eminently forgettable.
Oh, the problem we are. So I take it then, will you be able to come back and join us again in the not-too-distant future, should you remember?
I would be delighted if I can remember it. I'm a bit like Dory.
Oh, Lord. Corinne Sweet, we salute you. Take care now.
That you would just leave. Your presence still lingers here, and it won't leave me alone. These wounds won't seem to heal. This pain is just too real. There's just too much that time cannot erase. When you just too real. There's just too much.
now it's the reckoning. The £855 million Black Friday regret is the headline figure for what was spent during last year's Black Friday. That's already been exceeded this year in terms of 2017. And maybe we have actually started regretting almost instantly what we've actually purchased on the basis of, well, it was a bargain. Well, as we said, maybe it's only a bargain if you're going to buy it anyway. The best person to actually speak to when we start talking about sensible financial choices and really the appropriate way to actually deal with the Black Friday hangovers has to be ace financial journalist, TV presenter, humorist extraordinaire, generally an all-round wonderful person. It's Jasmine Birtles. How are you, Jasmine?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm feeling so much better having heard you describe me. I sound great, don't I?
But you are, Jasmine. This is one of the reasons we'd like to feature you on an annual basis, if not more. It's
absolutely
wonderful stuff. Oh. But moving on to this whole aspect of regretted purchases, clothing, TVs, tablets, gym equipment, smoothie makers. It does seem as though the huge, almost ideological brainwashing that we actually have about Black Friday, it kind of leads to an awful lot of people thinking it's purchase regret we're suffering from.
Absolutely, yes. And that's certainly what's been found by this survey by Gumtree.com. They found that we've spent £850 million that we then almost immediately regret. I mean, already they found that right now, a quarter of us are regretting how much we spent over Black Friday weekend or season. I mean, it's practically a season now. It's not even just the weekend. And one in 10 are regretting what they bought. So, you know, it's just Tuesday. Goodness knows how they're going to feel by next week.
Well, I'm not going to mention Cyber Monday and the post scripts to that, but that's another line entirely. Mm. In terms of the content that's actually there, I mean, we said at the start, it was something we talked about last week with a couple of other folk who are sharing the notion that, well, it's only going to be a bargain if it's something you were going to buy in any case.
Exactly.
And you see it reduced from that. So is it a case of we need to almost control our impulses and yet the advertisers would actually say, no, just go for it, just buy it now?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, essentially, and this is, I do money talks, I do money workshops in companies, and what I say to them is it is war on the high streets and online, because, you know, on the one hand, we are going about our days earning money, trying to keep ourselves going and put some money aside for the future. What the shops and other businesses are doing are trying to take the money off us in any way that they can. Mm. And what's happening is they're getting cleverer and cleverer at doing this. They're using psychological tactics, neuro-linguistic programming, both in the high street shops and online. And what they do, they try and stop you thinking. They want you to just react to their stimuli and sort of stop thinking and go, I need it, I've got to have it. You know, using things like fear tactics and urgency and, you've got to have it because everybody else has got it. All of these. So you think, oh, I've got to have it. And then it's just, you know, when you calm down a little bit later, maybe a few hours later, you think, hang on, what did I buy that for? I didn't even want it, let alone need it.
And this doesn't really seem to be gender specific. I mean, looking at, again, the survey, on average, men spent approximately £63, 80 pence, women £59, 6 pence, women 24% felt marginally more pressured than men. Not a great deal of difference there. I mean, it seems to, obviously, you know, it's gender blind in terms of the impact it actually provides for us.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, according to this survey, the top thing that people regret buying is clothes. So you could say maybe, you know, there's more women. After that, it's pretty much all gadgets, you know, iPhones or you know, tablets, all of that, and household gadgets and things that people regret. But I think it is gender blind. In some ways, you could say women are doing it more, but then I think women buy more things, but they're smaller. This is a sort of general trend in shopping. Women tend to buy more items, but smaller, cheaper items, whereas men tend to go for fewer big ticket items.
As technology becomes ever more pervasive, and we talk about wearable technology and heads-up sets, which actually personalise adverts to individual likes and dislikes and so on, is this war, quote unquote, something which you're going to see actually becoming more challenging. And we need to actually take that step back to actually say, no, I am not going to be suckered into this particular craze.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And this is, as you're talking about big data, you know, again, a huge weapon in the armory of the marketeers and the businesses, because the more they know about us, every time you spend, every time you use a credit card or a loyalty point, or every time you use your Oyster card or anything that's sort of digital, it maps what you're doing, where you're spending, when you're spending, what computer you're using to spend, or whether you use your mobile to buy things. All of this is sort of fed into the big data bank, and it creates a huge amount of in-depth knowledge that they have about us, so they can go, oh, you know, look, you like pink coats, Jasmine. Well, there's another nice pink coat here, and it's half price. Well, it's half the price that it used to be, which is still expensive, but whatever. You should have it because you like this, and you know your old one is starting to get a bit shabby now. And it does that specific thing that it's fairly sure you're going to prick your ears up at and go, oh yes, I sort of do want one of those. So as you say, we do need to get cleverer, and quite often, you know, look after yourself by literally not going into the shops, or literally not signing up to emails from shops that you like, because it'll come into your inbox and you go, oh yes, I did want one of those, I don't know why, but I just do. So, you know, physically keeping yourself away from temptation, like you wouldn't buy cakes if you're trying to die. It, you know, it's that kind of thing. Just keep yourself away from temptation.
We've come a long way since the 1920s and the Good Housekeeping magazine's seal of approval, which was used to actually sort of promote issues and so on 90 odd years ago.
Yeah.
Is there a case for saying that? I mean, because clearly, I have to hold my hand up, I quite like the reward system of certain supermarkets and stores, which obviously is all gathering, as you said, that big data for use with us and so on. Is there a case of we need to say just we've already talked about stepping back from that whole notion, but is there a solution? Is there a simple solution where you actually say, okay, apart from don't shop, because I can see people say, no, don't say that. It's how consumerism society is based on.
Yeah.
The whole thing would collapse on that basis if we didn't buy stuff to make us feel better, and then if we still feel worse, buy more stuff. But is it a case of saying, okay, have a balance in your life and actually focus on the key essentials, and as you rightly said, don't necessarily dive into the media maelstrom that events like Black Friday can cause?
Yes, definitely, and really think about what's important. You know, think ahead, think big, think when do you want to retire, what do you want for your children, and so how much money you're going to need for that, and then work back from there and say, well, if I'm going to need that, then I'm really going to have to cut back on a bit of spending here, or make a bit of extra money to put aside. And at the same time, think about what you love now, what's important now. You know, do you love clothes? Well, in that case, yes, yeah, spend money on clothes, but cut down on dinners out if you're not that so fussed. So think about that. And also, I run a National Clear Your Clutter Day every spring, because I can't stand clutter, and we are cluttered up. So have a plan that you're going to declutter. See what you've already got. You might find that you've got, you know, like, I mean, I hold up my hand here. When I decluttered, I found I had 3 pairs of pink trousers. 3 in my wardrobe. I just didn't even know I had them, which is why I bought
new ones.
Always
got to have a couple of spare pairs of pink trousers,
yes,
Jasmine. I mean, surely it's a well-worn thing. I mean, it's a fact of life, even from the days of Dickens. Surely pink trousers were there.
Pink trousers.
Yes.
They probably were as well. So, yeah, see what you've already got. Use what you've got. And what you're not fussed about, sell it. I mean, this is one of the things that Gumtree says. You know, sell what old things that you've got so that you can create room for new ones. Have a sort of one-in, one-out policy so that you don't clutter up everything and can't see the wood for the trees.
As ever, packed with sensible comments, as we knew you would be. JasmineBirtles.com is obviously a go-to website to find out more details about your good self. Gumtree presumably would be the best place to seek out more details about this survey, Jasmine.
Absolutely. Gumtree.com, that's where you can find it on the blog.
Excellent. And our concluding questions, which won't involve pink trousers, although I might actually sort of adapt them in various ways. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
I have had a more than reasonably interesting telephonic link. Thank you very much, kind sir.
Splendid. So I take it in 2018 we can hopefully look forward to connecting with you again for more matters financial and otherwise.
Absolutely, and I remain your obedient servant.
Oh,
thank you.
Splendid. Bring on the pink trousers. was Julie Andrews in the Classic Sound of Music who had the immortal song I Have Confidence in Me. But it seems, as we're into the 21st century, that actually women are lacking confidence for a third of their lives, which works out to around about 27 years of unconfident behaviour. The over 55s are the most confident age group, it would seem, and young people obviously tend to have confidence issues as well. To address some of the reasons why this C word, which is so vital and intrinsic to our lifestyle and format and quality of life as human beings, we're delighted to welcome two fine folk. First of all, that extraordinarily talented psychologist, the wonderful Jo Hemmings. How are you, Jo?
I'm very good, especially after that introduction. Thank you very much.
All good. And the equally wonderful spokesperson for LV, that would be John Sellers. How are you, John?
Good morning. Very good, thank you.
Excellent. Good confidence start there, which is marvellous from both interviewees. Joe, what's the secret to this confidence matters issue? I was actually speaking to somebody who shall remain nameless, who was having a panic, well, not a panic attack, that's too drastic, but was very concerned about coming and doing an interview with me, because she said, oh, I don't know, I've just lost the whole thing. And it's all about that confidence, the deadly words, I can't do that.
Yeah, it's very much about I can't do it. So really, this Confidence Matters research from LV, which has been commissioned to mark the launch of its Green Heart Foundation, you know, found these really large confidence gaps amongst particular groups in the UK, and women are especially affected, and young people aged 16 to 24. And what they found the confidence thing meant was people who, you know, if you're confident, you feel you can do something at any time. And really, these people, the respondents were saying, no, I don't feel confident. I don't feel I can do anything at any time. Generally, you know, it's the big things. It's health and wealth. These are the things that people really worry about, and it impacts on their confidence. But also, it's smaller things as well.
We all, as human beings, in most cases, unless there's a major reason in terms of a psychological element, tend to feel that we have to feel the fear and do it anyway. Doing what we're doing now, actually, talking in a kind of coherent manner with microphones in front of us, it's not a natural human activity. Fight or flight kicks into place, and hopefully John won't run away from the studio. It's all right, John, calm down.
he was just out the door, he just spoke.
Exactly.
Thank goodness you said that.
But is it a case of all almost having to, I mean, it sounds just so trite to say, oh, have confidence in yourself, work through that process. Is it a case of taking baby steps and actually building up those confidence? Because it's so easy to, as you've rightly said, have our confidence knocked.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think one of the things I feel is never sort of feel afraid of asking for help if you're feeling unconfident. Obviously, sort of LV and the Green Heart Matters, they sort of giving people that confidence, but just asking a friend, asking a colleague, reaching out for help, you know, is a big thing with confidence. And of course, it ebbs and flows. You know, there are big factors in our lives which affect it. But when things are going well, conversely, we feel more confident. I think what's worrying is it's the young millennials, you know, these people, it's sort of there's a kind of despair going on into their future, which has had quite a major impact on their confidence.
And presumably branding such as Generation Snowflake don't exactly help matters, do they, really?
Do you know that phrase really? I hate that phrase.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. It's so unfair because it's a label that they then, as you absolutely say, have to sort of live with, and it does no favours whatsoever to their self-belief.
John, let's talk to your good self for a few moments. The Green Heart Foundation, existing to give help, support and confidence to people who need it most. Was this something that kind of you thought, yeah, actually we want to set up something which is going to provide that helping hand?
Yeah, well, confidence is at the heart of what we do as a business. Our products and services are there to give people confidence that when something bad happens, we've got their back. But just from talking to customers, we thought, well, that doesn't always feel enough. We just want to do some more. So as an example, there was an elderly woman who contacted us a few weeks ago, sadly to say that her partner had died, her husband had died, and she was really worried about the fact that she couldn't go to his funeral because she was bedbound and wasn't able to afford to get there. And we just thought that was wrong and something needed to be done about that. So we paid for a private ambulance to take her to the funeral and back, so she had the confidence that she could be there to say goodbye to her loved one. So it's things like that, really.
Yeah, the challenges that we tend to face with on a day-by-day basis. Joe, returning briefly to yourself, there is that line, of course, the fine line between overconfidence, confidence and arrogance. And is it a case of getting the balance right that ultimately is the key to success?
Yes, it is. I mean, obviously, I mean, confidence in that sense of feeling secure and feeling like you are able to do anything is great. Obviously, when you get to arrogance, that's lost its sense of perspective. And that's an attitude that says, yes, I can do it, but I can do it better than anybody else. So I actually don't even relate confidence and arrogance that much, because there are some very arrogant people around who actually aren't that confident, but they wear arrogance as a sort of mask, if you like, to compensate for perhaps not being as confident as they really are. And of course, it's never a good look. Indeed. Or sound.
Or else become members of parliament, but I won't go any further on that particular line because for obvious reasons.
I was going to say present breakfast TV shows, but I really shouldn't say
No, please step away from that whole system. There is a sense, of course, that as we become more chronologically gifted, as we become more experientially enhanced, as add up the years and so on, that actually we realise that the things we were frightened and concerned about or worried about, at the end of the day, they haven't impacted on us negatively. There have been positive things. This notion that confidence grows with age and the over 55s being the most confident, is that also a case of, well, what the hey, we don't care anymore?
Yeah, to a degree. And they've lived life and they've got used to facing their fears and doing it anyway. I mean, this LV research showed a steady increase in confidence, particularly improvement after the age of 45. And then again at 55, which I think is brilliant, given those are the sort of times when you'd think people might start worrying about health and wealth again. It seems to me that at that particular time in life, they're the most relaxed, most sure of themselves, and most confident.
John, were you surprised by any of the results of the research?
We were surprised by the size of the gap, yes. The fact that it does impact both sexes and it impacts all sorts of different age demographics as well. But we think that we're sort of calling on everybody really to look out for one another. It can be little things that can give people a confidence boost. The introduction that you gave to both of us today, that would have given us a confidence boost. Mm-hmm. It's a really nice thing to say. So you really look out for your friends, look out for your family, and don't be afraid to ask if you are feeling that you're having that confidence hit.
It's all very sincere and well meant. It's not meant as a technique, of course, but then again, you can see it as that way. Joe, in terms of the forthcoming sort of aspects of these, I mean, we're looking at some of the things that are not confidence, things like arguments with family or friends, being the victim of fraud, financial security, receiving a bill, going overdrawn. Money seems to really impact on the whole confidence issue, as perhaps we might expect.
Yes, I mean, obviously, financial security is absolutely key in this day and age. So it does worry people. And again, health of themselves and health of their loved ones. And again, from this research, we can see that if those two things are secure and people feel okay about them, then they naturally have a confidence rise. But as John was saying, you know, this way of A, reaching out and asking for help, which is fine, and B, the kind spiritedness to other people to support them when they're going through difficult times, not only boosts their confidence, actually boosts the person who's giving the advice. So it's a kind of win-win situation. The thing is, do not keep it to yourself. I think that and fester on it, because those are the things that really do impact long term on both our confidence and our self-esteem.
Don't head down the vicious circle, go for the virtuous circle. Perhaps we can sum it up from that perspective. The virtuous circle of a green heart. lv.com/greenheartfoundation. I presume, John, is the best place to go to for further information?
Absolutely, yes, please.
And the final two questions. Have you both had a reasonably confident and informative telephonic link with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for yourself, John?
It's been great, thank you. And great
Joe,
to have you on.
And Joe?
An absolute pleasure, as always.
Genuine delight, as ever. Joe Hemmings, ace thank psychologist you. And ace spokesperson for LV, John Sellers. Many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you.
Thanks.
See, it all ends happily in the end. Okay, very quickly, thanks to Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Phil Leonis, Dr. David Lewis, Corinne Sweet, Jasmine Birtles, Kevin Pratt and Joe Hemmings. And a whole stack of other scenarios, though. We still have various other folk trying to fit in. We couldn't, just not enough time, Shaylee.
Time flies when you're having fun.
We have confidence in ourselves. That's the important thing. Be confident. That's the way forward. And it is, as far as Siren Radio is concerned, a wonderful selection of top music exists for the rest of the day. I think that we might have our Sari News team coming in just after 10 o'clock to do a little piece from there. I'll just talk a little bit through the process. And, of course, a reminder that the Stone Tapes gets an airing this evening with an adventuresome Sam Stone and a special guest appearance on the Stone Tapes by the host of Sound and Country Vision, Tessa Snart.
I did see that.
Yeah, so where Tessa takes Sound and Country Vision in terms of science fiction is a whole new field. But it's superheroes. They're focusing on superheroes. That's all I'll actually say at this particular moment. You want the rest of it? Check out George Mann, Sam Stone, David J. Howe, Robin Pierce, Patricia Ash, and Tessa Snart on the Stone Tapes this evening on Siren Radio. Excellent. And so that's pretty much it. As we say, we've got probably 2 minutes. Otherwise, we just have a couple of moments of silence whilst the news should actually come through. So we'll talk through that whole process, and then the magic will start. Anything lined up for today, Shaley? Anything exciting? Will you be heading off into the wild blue yonder, collecting obviously your Phil Leonis directed Truth Is Out There DVD en route?
Oh, I'm excited to finally watch that, Alex. And no, unfortunately not. Just work.
it'll open up a whole range of things. Up to come in the next hour, we've got Anne Marie and Heavy. We've got Likey Lai, I Follow Rivers, Deus and Hotel Lounge, and just so much magical stuff. It's frighteningly, just frighteningly wonderful. That's the key thing.
Don't go anywhere else.
You say frighteningly wonderful is a whole system. And just looking ahead, don't forget Midweek Drive's choir will be in, or rather Ed Wellman with the head of the choir will be talking and singing Christmas Carols, week on Wednesday. That's the 13th of December.
Oh, man.
Finally, just been added this in the news department thing from John Wenham, of course, our events guru. As mentioned this morning, it is the weekend of the Lincoln Food and Gift Fair. That's at the Lincolnshire Showground. Well worth attending on Saturday or Sunday. We'll be finding all sorts of things. Author George Mann will actually be there with his family, so you might want to do a bit of celebrity spotting from that point of view. And you'll have folk from the Lincoln New Theatre Royal Christmas pantomime there as well.
It's Aladdin, isn't it?
Aladdin Sane, as David Bowie once said. No, just Aladdin, with lamps, with a whole heap of other goodies. We'll also be doing a special programme from that for the Midweek Drive, which will be going out probably Saturday morning. We'll be recording it on Friday night. We'll do a little press preview. And you may be there, Shaley.
I may indeed.
You see, that's just more things. I always like to think of it as the precursor to the Christmas market, which you may appreciate, Lincoln listener, takes place next week.
Next Thursday, I think.
That's the official launch of the whole thing. And it's nice to see that the weather is becoming just that teensy-weensy bit frosty, just as a way of actually celebrating the joy of the Lincoln Christmas market. Have you been before?
Oh, yeah, no, I love it. Definitely ditch the car, though. Living near the Balegate, walking is the only mode of transport that is acceptable.
And also wear sensible shoes.
Definitely.
If it is icy, you do not want to be walking up or down steep
hill. Are they doing the one-way system again this year?
As far as I'm aware, that's the case. Okay. And that's why we've called it the Midweek Drive Morning Edition, to actually, right at the very end, introduce a bit of driving information. Very good. Actually, we've had health warnings and various other bits and pieces. Okay, as our construction workers have continued to sort of wrap up, they're going out of here. Anne-Marie and Heavy is up next. And then all sorts of other wonderful things here on Siren Radio, Lincoln's sensational radio community station.
Always.
Marvellous.
When did we get so lost inside ourselves? We used to be strong,